This podcast was recorded at 5 p.m. on November 1st, 2019. Things may have changed by the time you hear it. Any opinions expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and do not represent WSUM, the UW-Madison Board of Regents, nor The Wire, which takes no institutional positions. Welcome back to The Wirecast, where we break down and analyze the items defining the international news agenda. And I'm very excited to announce that for the first time on The Wirecast, we have not one, but two of our fabulous editors here to help me co-host this podcast. We've got returning Emily Janicek and new to The Wire, Ryan Teeley. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us today for your first time on The Wirecast.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And Emily, so great to have you back. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
I'm just happy that we're all here. I'm really excited to get this tag team up here in the studio because we have a trio of issues that's definitely going to need a team of three to tackle because continuing to be in the news because it never seems to exit the news is the story of perhaps the longest exit I've ever read about, Brexit.
Yes, Brexit has had a couple of substantial updates within the last couple of weeks. The do or die deadline on October 31st has been pushed back once again to January 31st, 2020. The EU has agreed to extend the Brexit deadline, which allows the UK to hold elections in December, on December 6th. Currently, the Tories are leading and Labour is going for a broader platform. So we will see how that shakes out. Sam, Ryan, what do you have to say about this new election coming up in December?
Well, first of all, just for a bit of projections, I do have some polling numbers here that were aggregated by the Financial Times this morning based off of a number of different polls just asking UK voters about who they would prefer in a general election ballot. And right now, the Tories are in the lead. They've got about 37% of respondents saying that they would favor voting for the Tories in this upcoming December election. Labour's coming in next with about 25%, and then the Liberal Democrats are in third at 18%, and then Nigel Farage's Brexit Party is coming in fourth at about 10%. So it seems just based upon these polling numbers that it's likely that the Conservatives are going to be able to hang on to their majority. But keep in mind, we are in only the first couple of days of the campaigning season. So just about anything could happen between now and early December when these elections are actually going to happen, especially since there are still going to be these continued high-profile Brexit negotiations, which may impact the feelings of voters. And the last thing that I want to say about these polls is that even though they do kind of show a bit of a plurality for the Tories, it's difficult to feign any kind of Brexit implications from them because people's loyalties and preferences about Brexit cross-cut different parties. There are people in the Conservative Party who support and oppose Brexit, and the same with the Labour Party. So we can't necessarily be sure what these numbers will mean in terms of if the UK will follow through with its Brexit plans, only what we might be able to assume the results of this election will be.
Absolutely. And not to mention that the Brexit Party, they're a no-deal party. So Farage is pushing his party out there saying, we just want Brexit. We don't want any deals. But the Conservatives, the Tories, are saying, well, we're okay with looking at a deal. And so as Farage is trying to boost his polling numbers and the Conservatives are trying to hold on, an alliance may be likely, but then you're putting the Conservatives in this position of, well, do we go forward with our deal, Boris Johnson's deal that was rejected by Parliament, or do we bring in the Brexit Party, just leave the European Union in January and figure out what happens from there?
That's very true. And recently, one person who's also been pushing for this Brexit Party, Tory Party alliance has been the United States' President Donald Trump, who just yesterday called into Nigel Farage's radio show and actually chatted with him about the upcoming election, the Brexit negotiations, and a bunch of just other UK topics. Trump actually pressured Farage to align forces with the Tories, and he said that they'd be quote-unquote unstoppable. However, you're right. We're not necessarily sure if this is what's actually going to happen, because this division with UKIP and the Brexit Party wanting this clean break while the Tories want a plan is the reason why these Brexit Party politicians are running. You know, they're running and challenging these Tories in their own district, where they think they can kind of outflank them to the right on this one specific issue. And the last couple sources that I've read have said that Johnson, Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom and leader of the Conservative Party, has been against aligning with the Brexit Party for this very reason. So while there certainly is pressure from some voters and some very high-profile international politicians for these parties to meld, just might not be happening with how contentious this issue is.
I really don't think an alliance between the two is going to work out. I think Johnson will try and lean on the Democratic Unionist Party, which is a Northern Irish party. Theresa May tried to lean on them. It didn't work out with her deals. So I think he might try to bring them in. But at the end of the day, he needs to make a decision of, do I push the Conservatives toward a no-deal Brexit or a deal Brexit? And that's going to change how he aligns with certain parties, especially his relations with Labour, who is having issues coming up with some straight platform of we're in favor of leave or we're in favor of remain.
Yes. So going back to Johnson, he attempted to put his revised deal to Parliament on October 19th, and it ended up being voted down. Basically, the deal was very similar to Theresa May's, but the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, tweeted in response to the announcement that Johnson's negotiated a worse deal than Theresa May and that it should be rejected because it has the same financial settlement and treatment of EU citizens in the UK and UK citizens in the EU. But besides that, the big negotiating factor moving forward is the Irish border between Southern Ireland and Northern Ireland, which has been causing a lot of issues. Sam, Ryan, thoughts?
Yeah, so the Irish border has always been a very contentious subject in the EU and the UK negotiations. Ireland and Northern Ireland, they had a 30-year period of violence between the two. A lot of parliamentarians and unionists wanted Northern Ireland to stay with the UK. A lot of other people wanted Northern Ireland to actually join up with Ireland and unite under one banner. That was settled in 1998. And now these days, with this possibility of a hard Brexit, this no-deal Brexit, that would create a border between a Northern Irish province and then Ireland itself. And that's going to reduce trade and it's going to reduce movement. So this question of the Irish border has held back all negotiations. Theresa May wanted to keep the UK in the customs union, pretty much saying, well, we will leave the UK, but we'll just stay in the economic union for a little while until we figure it out. Boris Johnson said, well, what if we moved Britain out and we kept Northern Ireland in? This way there wouldn't be any flaring up of any tensions. That was shot down in Parliament. So now the question is, moving forward, really the biggest problem that's going to stop Brexit is what do we do with the Irish border?
One thing that I do want to come back to in talking about the election, you know, we've been kind of talking about some of the infighting and difficulties between the conservative wing of the electorate, between the Brexit Party and the Tories Party. But I'd like to talk about the Labour Party a little bit as well, because they're also trying to claim a majority in Parliament through this election, and they're coming at this with a little bit of a unique strategy, whereas the Tories and the Brexit Party are focusing this election around the issue explicitly of Brexit. The Labour is approaching the population with a little bit of a different pitch. They are trying to appeal to voters by painting this election as more than just Brexit. A lot of their posturing focuses on domestic issues like battling corruption or cutting down tax dodgers, opposing certain austerity policies or environmentalist policies. So the question that I want to throw to you guys is, how effective do you think this strategy is going to be, and what do you think Labour's chances are heading into this snap election?
Well, honestly, Labour Party has an opportunity here to put itself out as the post-Brexit party, that if you elect us, should Brexit continue to happen and we eventually leave the European Union, we're the party that can lead the country after Brexit. But the issue with the Labour Party is that a lot of their constituencies, and this is why Nigel Farage and the Brexit Party are targeting Labour seats, is because Labour is split. many of their constituencies voted in favor of leaving the European Union, while they're also trying to finagle it in the media of, well, we're not really sure how we're going to lean. And so the smartest move for them is to kind of dodge the broader Brexit question of leaving or remaining and kind of setting themselves up as, we are the post-Brexit party, as compared to the Tories who are saying, we're going to get Brexit done, so vote for us.
Yeah, and I think that the Labour Party strategy by being a quote-unquote post-Brexit party is somewhat smart, because I know if I was a British citizen, I would be sick of hearing about Brexit for, what is it, 3-4 years now at this point? So it's a topic that's just dominated the media for so long. So I think it's refreshing that they're trying to focus on real issues that do affect the country that just haven't gotten the attention that they deserve. And also, I've read that the Labour Party could possibly try and have another public vote on Brexit in the future. So this definitely would sway me as a voter, and it's something to consider for voters to consider moving forward.
Yes, I've also seen kind of musings among certain Labour Party politicians that they might put Brexit to another referendum, but it is actually part of their Brexit plan, or plan to just carry out the negotiations, that another referendum would be part of it. Specifically, they advertise in terms of Brexit that if they were elected, they would negotiate a plan, but then put up a referendum where voters would be able to choose either that plan or remaining in the EU. So while that's not an explicit another should we continue with Brexit, it would give voters that final opt-out chance, you know, last stop before Knoxville or whatever kind of option. But I think this posturing that we've been kind of talking about reflects, Ryan, what you were talking about with those internal divisions in the Labour Party, because there is this division in the party. And I think that this plan and also their posturing reflects that, because if they can focus on other issues, other domestic issues, well, then maybe some of the people who are kind of teetering on the fence between Labour and another party because of their Brexit views will be able to just kind of ignore that for a little while, look past it, and focus on other domestic issues. Or they might still be able to follow through with the Labour Party, knowing that their Brexit plan gives them that last-minute escape route as well. So I think this is probably a bit of a conscious rhetorical strategy as well, to just kind of sidebar some of those internal divisions about Brexit within their own party, at least for the time being.
And who knows if it's actually going to work? You know, the Labour Party putting themselves out there as the post-Brexit party, but half of their constituents have wanted to leave. So in the long run, I'm not sure if it'll work. I think the Conservatives will be able to hold on by saying that, listen, we're the party that can get it done, because if you vote Labour, you're going to end up either staying in the European Union or it's just not going to get done either. So you might as well stick with us. That's kind of their pitch, and it's worked so far. I mean, they held on with Theresa May and how many failed deals that she had, and yet they're still in power. And I think they have a better shot of holding on under their current motto and platform rather than Labour's "we're the post-Brexit party" pitch.
All right. So I think it's that time when we're talking about Brexit where we get our crystal balls out, if we are so willing. Is this going to be the one? Is this going to be the one where they actually find a deal? Or are there just going to be more extensions or more missed deadlines? What do you guys see in the future in terms of Brexit and if the UK is going to leave the European Union?
You know, I would love to say that this is the time when it will happen, but I have a hard time believing that it will. Considering that Johnson's most recent deal was not significantly different from past deals, and it didn't take any different stance on an Irish border. We'll see how this new election shakes out. Perhaps if the Labour Party wins, then things will be different. But even then, if they do win, I have a hard time believing that they'll be able to formulate a new Brexit plan with such a quick turnaround.
If I have to get out my crystal ball, I think that in the long run, that no deal is going to satisfy every faction. You're going to have the Northern Irish Party that just wants to get out. You're going to want the Labour Party that might lean on remaining in the European Union. And the Conservatives are going to be stuck in the middle between, do we leave with a deal or do we leave with no deal? I think it's going to come to where the UK is going to mess up. They're not going to be able to get a deal passed. And they're going to ask the European Union for an extension. And the countries of the European Union are going to say enough. And we're not going to give you an extension. And then by then it's a hard Brexit. And then now you're in post-Brexit territory with no deal, and the UK needs to figure out what to do next. There's been talks of a free trade agreement with the United States, and then figuring out a free trade agreement with the European Union separate from Brexit. I don't see those as legitimate and realistic as of now. There's so many questions regarding, are we going to leave with a deal or not? I think that they're going to leave. It's a matter of deal or no deal. And I think it's going to lean on the no deal.
And I think that whole dynamic between the EU being willing to give the UK further extensions is such an interesting game, you know, because they both have vested interests in each outcome. On one hand, the EU knows that it will do better economically if they maintain some kind of trading relationship with the UK.
I think the UK provides about 15% of the European Union's economy. So it's a big loss.
Oh, yeah. So that hard exit would be crippling, no less. But at the same time, they want to send that strong message of you are going to get hurt and you are going to suffer if you decide to leave the EU in order to dissuade and disincentivize other countries. So I think we're in real time seeing a really, really interesting example of like repeated encounters and just waning patience of players as they keep returning to essentially make the same choice, either extend the deadline and signal to other countries that they might be a little bit weaker in negotiations than they want to appear, or to say enough's enough, kind of pull the grim trigger, if you will, and kick the UK out of the EU with no deal. So I think like every interaction is just another really interesting signaling game between the EU and the UK. And eventually we'll define how credible any type of threat from the EU is to other countries if they decide to leave, if the EU starts pressing them on some of the negative ramifications of leaving.
I think that's a really good point, because when we talk about Brexit, we talk a lot about the UK leaving, but we don't really talk about what's going to be the effect on the European Union. The EU has so many problems going on outside of its borders. They have a lot of the eastern countries like Hungary and Poland that are very Eurosceptic. You have the question of bringing other countries in the European Union. France just voted no on Northern Macedonia, for example. So how do you deal with the Balkans? And not to mention that you also have China that's getting very involved in the Balkans. They have invested heavily in Serbia, for example. So they have so many issues going on. I think they want to end Brexit as quickly as possible, but they also don't want to be crippled in the process. So it's a matter of flipping coins and seeing where everything lands.
All right. And now as we're starting to move east, it sounds like we're starting to exit Brexit and get nearer to Syria. And oh boy, have there been things going on in Syria?
Where do you start?
Yeah, where do we start? Where I'm going to start, I guess, is just kind of following up with where we left off last episode. Because in the last episode, it was the middle of an excited and frantic pullout of United States forces. And now that we've had a couple of weeks since then, the dust has settled a bit, and we've kind of been able to understand where the players are sitting. So the pullout was incredibly rushed. Like, we saw certain images of, like, U.S. bases just abandoned, but with refrigerators, like, fully stocked with food and soda, half-eaten MREs sitting on the table. So it really was a rushed pullout that I don't think in the moment we were able to understand the full implications of just how dramatic and quick this decision was. But of course, we have seen a resulting incredible anger from Kurdish troops and militants who we had been working with in the area. We saw a couple of videos that surfaced of civilians hurling rocks and potatoes at U.S. tanks and armored vehicles as they're driving away. But after that initial chaos, we kind of figured out that this isn't really a pullout. U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper announced that all troops leaving Syria will actually be relocated to Western Iraq to mostly continue to fight ISIS. And that's going to be the large majority of the roughly 1,000 troops that we had in Syria. But at the same time, a small number of troops are going to remain in Syria, specifically the southeastern portion of it, to secure certain oil fields that were once held by ISIS. So even though Trump on Twitter and certain other officials in the administration are pitching this as returning the troops to home and ending, quote unquote, endless wars in the Middle East, these troops really aren't coming home just yet. They're either being sent right across the border to Iraq or just to different places in Syria to secure these oil fields. The last and final issue that's kind of been happening in the region is the death of Bakar al-Baghdadi. The United States conducted a raid that successfully killed the once leader of ISIS, who was also their leader during the peak of their caliphate. This death actually only yesterday was confirmed by ISIS as well. So it's a pretty complex situation developing in Syria. I just kind of wanted to lay all the chips on the table so we could just kind of, you know, pick up the ones we wanted to and just expand on them.
Well, right off the bat, you have a lot of Congress people coming out and saying this is an awful decision. Lindsey Graham, who's arguably one of the most vocal senators, even he tweeted out that said, if press reports are accurate, this is a disaster in the making. The pullout in Syria, on one hand, I can understand the non-interventionist point of view and getting out of the conflict, that getting out of the Middle East. We've been there since, you know, 2003 at the most. But pulling out of this battle zone when our allies, the Kurds, are alone and who we have provided so much material and forces for, now they're being shelled by Turkey and they've been forced to make concessions on the land that they got back from ISIS. It's a really just really sticky situation because our number one ally in the region is now alone, stuck between Turkey and Syria. Not to mention Russia was kind of sprinkled in there for a little bit.
And what's worse is that the Kurds were forced to make a deal with the Syrian government, which the U.S. does not support. So by pulling out these troops and creating this power vacuum, it really has left a large stain on our alliances in the Middle East.
And you alluded to Russian forces coming in there. Some reporting from Al Jazeera that broke just this morning is that Turkey and Russia have now begun joint patrols in northern Syria. So as plenty of people predicted, Russia is dramatically working to fill this power vacuum that was left by the United States in their pullout from northern Syria, and is now assisting Turkey in controlling and claiming some of this region from the Kurds. And of course, the implications for the Assad government are huge, because Russia has been a reliable ally to Assad way back even before the 2011 Syrian civil war. And Russian aid to the Syrian government is one of the main reasons why the Syrian government was able to wage its mostly successful campaign against Syrian rebels. With the United States pulling out, it's not just upsetting the power balance, giving the Turks more of an advantage over the Kurds, but the long-term implications are going to be for a stronger influence of the Assad government in the region as well.
And, you know, you look at Russia and Russia's influence. Russia has always wanted to have a play in the Middle East. They invaded Afghanistan in 1979. They pulled out in 89 when the American and Saudi Arabian-backed Mujahideen kicked them out. And so they've always had what I think is this desire to expand their influence into the Middle East. They've supported Syria, and they've supported Iran, for example, especially when Iran was reaching into Iraq and Syria during all these conflicts. They didn't really care for the Kurds, especially since the Kurds were one of America's number one allies during the Iraq War. But you're seeing that Russia is trying to expand its influence into this region. They have a new Eurasian Economic Union with some of these like Azerbaijan and all these other states. There's talk of Uzbekistan joining this union. And there are some commenters that say this is a new Warsaw Pact. And with this new Warsaw Pact type group, Russia is trying to bring back all these this version of a satellite state. And so they can do that with Syria, and they can do that by warming up to Turkey. And so now that the United States has pulled out, it's perfect for Russia to now come in and establish dominance in the region, at least in northern Middle East, because I would argue that the United States still has dominance in the south with Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
All right. And with that, speaking of conflicts between authoritarian regimes and their people, we're going to travel quite far from Syria to Hong Kong. Would that be like nearly the other side of the globe? What do you guys think? Like maybe like a third of the
world? Well, if you take the Middle East at like the very straight definition, you could argue, they're maybe like a third of the way.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So we're gonna spin that big, beautiful blue ball about a third and head over to Hong Kong, where the incredible unrest and sustained protest continue.
What's very interesting is that this has been building up for a couple years. This isn't something that just came out of nowhere. Hong Kong has been protesting at the very least since 2016. But then they were arguing in favor of universal suffrage for their elected government. Currently, as it stands, they can have a little bit of elections, but at the end of the day, most of the important roles are appointed by the People's Republic of China. And now we're seeing Hong Kong with the extradition bill that was proposed by the Hong Kong government. The extradition bill would have allowed Hong Kong citizens that broke Chinese laws to be extradited to China to be tried and convicted there. What the issue with that is that Hong Kong is a special administrative region, a SAR, and that means that they have a certain level of autonomy granted to them that's not granted anywhere else, with the exception of Macau, which is about 30, 40 miles west. And that's where the crux of the protest came from. And from there, it kind of just boiled down to this greater feeling that Hong Kong is different from China and we want to maintain our autonomy. And it's ballooned from there.
Yeah, I agree. And I think one of the really interesting aspects about this protest is just the fact that it has been boiling for so long, but then it's finally kicked off. Because while the protests definitely started about this extradition bill, you're right, they're about so much more now. And I think their massive and continued scale only speaks to just how prevalent but also unseen this conflict was in the everyday lives of Hong Kongers. And now just essentially the extradition bill was just the necessary excuse they needed to let it spill over into the streets and to take all of this pent-up rage and unrest about so much that they have issue with Beijing and the Chinese government and let it manifest in these protests. So while definitely we started at these extradition bills, it's so much more now.
Yeah, the Hong Kong protesters are now demanding independent commissions to look into police brutality and the rule of law as a whole. They're now ramping up the demands for universal suffrage for their entire government, which obviously China is not going to want to do. They have the power to appoint government officials, so why would they want to give that power up? And it seriously contrasts to the other special administrative region, Macau. Macau is much, much smaller than Hong Kong. They were owned by the Portuguese before given back to China, and they've been run by China for really the last 50 years. And they're sitting on a huge casino industry, and there's no protests over there. But they've been assimilated so much into the Chinese culture, half of their population was born on the mainland, compared to Hong Kong, where 20% of the population was born on the mainland. So they have wildly different cultures. It's very interesting to see how one of the SARs is protesting in the millions. They had reports of up to 2 million people protesting at one point in time. That's like a quarter of the Hong Kong population, or just about, compared to Macau, which is less than 1 million, and there's nothing going on over there. And China has its hands tied, because what are they supposed to do? You know, do they send troops in and establish law and order? That's not going to look good, especially since they're guaranteed a level of autonomy. That's going to look absolutely awful. Or do they let it go, and then the Chinese government looks weak, because now you have millions of people protesting against not only their Hong Kong government, but China as a whole. And that's going to really show some cracks in the Chinese institutions.
Indeed. Although I do, and I think you definitely saw that tension manifest itself in the early days of the protest, because police were, at least from what we were able to see, using a considerable amount of restraint. You didn't see a lot of the images that you might expect to see when an authoritarian regime takes on democratic protesters, of serious police violence or brutality or heavy weaponry being at least shown off and flashed against protesting populations, because you're absolutely right. The Chinese government was very actively trying to avoid those type of images sprawling out into the public. But the risk that they ran was that, well, that only further emboldened protesters. And I think that since the protests have been running on for so long, the answer has definitely been yes. And now what we're seeing is a little bit of transition into more significant and forceful anti-protest and even violent anti-protest tactics from the Hong Kong police. Some reporting from Al Jazeera that just came out this morning pointed out that Hong Kong police are now using rubber bullets, tear gas, and beanbag rounds to repel and do crowd control on lots of these populations. And I've read a couple of reports of them even firing off live ammunition, but only into the air. So I do think we might be reaching a critical point in these protests where police are changing their tactics from these nonviolent ones in order to try and avoid those type of international images or repercussions into one where they're thinking, this has gone on long enough. We need to take on these tactics.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, you try to be – it's important to be objective and try to be fair. You know, if protesters are causing massive property damage and they're harming innocent people that aren't partaking, then you can kind of understand when the police would get involved in heightened levels of force. But just the footages that are coming out and the reports, you're seeing protesters literally just standing there and talking and – police coming up and pepper spraying them and beating them. And it gives a really bad image for China. And I'm really, it's unfortunate to say, but I'm really interested in where this is going to go. Because on one hand, is the Chinese army going to run tanks down the streets, or are they just going to let this go? And I don't think it's going to be the latter.
And, you know, that is why one of the demands is an independent inquiry into alleged police brutality, because of the amount of violence that's starting to ramp up. I read a report recently that said even though the police were firing live rounds just into the air, it still struck someone in the chest. So I can only imagine what's going to happen moving on in the future, because there's no end in sight to these protests.
And with the expansion problem or the expansion projects that Beijing has, their Belt and Road Initiative, the Taiwan question is always that's always been there. They really don't need a Hong Kong situation right now. They really don't need millions of people protesting and setting a bad image for themselves while they're trying to go across the globe and establish, you know, infrastructure plans in developing countries and really try to push themselves to be the global superpower. And they can't really do that when a large, not a large part of your population, but a very vocal part of the population in one of your special regions hates you.
Well, you're right. I mean, I think that there's a certain parallel to the relationship between the EU and the UK there, because each is trying to send a certain signal to other populations through its treatment of a population inside it. Because just as the EU is trying to show other European Union countries that leaving the EU is going to be a long, painful process through its treatment of the UK, the Chinese government is trying to show both Taiwan, Macau, and other regions that might have some risk of trying to seek independence, or these other regions in Africa or the Middle East, where they are developing their One Belt and One Road initiative, that defiance is meaningless and submission is necessary to the Chinese government either for your continued protection and running or for the kind of infrastructure and foreign direct investment promises that we've made. But at the same time, both are walking that fine line where an overreaction to these defiant populations might have an even worse effect of turning these other ones against them or emboldening resistance.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you look at China and they're allowing these protests to go on, but in marching soldiers down the street is going to look bad. And they have so many issues going on that is making them look bad that they are trying to figure out the best way to put these things down in a way without anybody really freaking out about it. I think that's why the Hong Kong police has so much power in what they're doing, the violence that's going on in Hong Kong. The Uyghur people out in Western China, reports come out all the time about tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people are in internment camps. And then not to mention, you have countries like Sri Lanka, which have a negative view of China because of the Belt and Road Initiative, the indebting that China is putting on these developing countries. It's kind of hard to develop when a good portion of your infrastructure is owned by Chinese companies or built by Chinese companies and used by the Chinese government, regardless of what you have to say about it. It's going to be really interesting over the next few months to see how Hong Kong plays out, because that's going to show how China is going to come and deal with some of these other greater geopolitical issues as well as their internal issues.
Not only it will be interesting to see how the protests shake out, but just today it came out that after 5 months of protests, the territory's economy has dropped into a recession at this point. Their GDP has dropped by 3.2% in 3 months, which is a significant amount. So obviously moving forward, we'll have to see how government policy, but also economic policy, how they move forward.
Sure. Macau, their economy was, President Xi Jinping actually came out and said that Macau needs to diversify its economy. You can't just rely on gambling anymore. And then China as a whole, their economy is slowing. So it's no surprise that Hong Kong has been declining in terms of economic growth. But to hit a recession in the short amount of time that it has is astounding.
And I think there's going to be direct ramifications on that to the protest in and of itself, most notably further emboldening violence. I mean, if people start to feel a sense of economic unrest because of the situation, that's only going to make them more aggressive in these protests and more desperate as well. And then when you combine that with the trend that we've seen of the police also becoming more violent in their resistance to these protesters, unfortunately, I really feel like this is just a powder keg just waiting for that ricocheted round of live ammunition once shot in the air.
Absolutely. And it's going to be one-sided. You know, it's going to be the Chinese government shooting down if it comes to that. And God hopes that it doesn't. But protesters don't have firearms. The United States is one of the few countries that allows citizens to carry firearms. And it's going to be kind of hard to fight back when you don't have guns.
Are we willing to make that prediction? Are we willing to say that there is likely going to be some kind of violent crackdown by either the Hong Kong police or Chinese military on these protesters? Are we ready to say that?
I mean, given that this has been going on for 5 months and only one of the conditions has been met at this point, I wouldn't be surprised if it happens in the future. Whether it's by the Chinese government or the Hong Kong police, I can't tell you, but with no end in sight, and especially with an economy that's slipping, something's going to happen.
Yeah, and not to mention, China doesn't want these protests to go on. And so I think either they're going to succumb to the protesters' demands and then try and finagle their way into keeping control. You know, okay, we'll create an independent commission, but we're going to appoint the people on the commission, which defeats the purpose of independence. But that's just how China would probably act. I don't know if it's going to come to straight-up violence, and if it does, I think it'll be blaming the protesters, that the protesters, something will happen, maybe a large piece of property will be destroyed, and whether it's actually the protesters doing it or the government does it, that there will be that excuse for the Chinese government to finally violently crack down on the protests because of some issue that comes up. I don't think it'll just be a spur of the moment where President Xi says, all right, it's time to send in the tanks. It'll definitely be some big catalyst that sparks it.
Well, with that is going to close this portion of the Wirecast. Emily, Ryan, thank you guys so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, no problem. I'm just glad that we could form this, you know, troublesome trio. You can read more from The Wire on these subjects and a lot more on thewire.wisc.edu. Check out our prior episodes of The Wirecast in your podcast feed, either on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. The Wirecast is a production of WSUM 91.7 FM Madison Student Radio. With that, I'm Sam Beisman.
I'm Ryan Teeley.
I'm Emily Janicek.
And thank you for listening to another episode of The Wirecast.